Katie.
I'm Erica.
And this is Book Talk.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Erica.
Welcome to Book Talk, your weekly podcast book club. This is the second episode of the second section of the Rabbit Hutch, the Rabbit Hutch. I don't know why I can't say words. And this book is by Tess Gunty. Before we start talking about this section, Katie's going to summarize what we read so that we can all remember. A lot actually happened in this section.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to be able to summarize it. I'm sure, per usual, I forgot some things since I read this in multiple sections. But I'm going to summarize this by giving you the town gossip story by story. We're going to start with Moses, who is Elsie. Remember her, our famous actress. This is her son. He enjoys putting glow paint on himself and then going into people's homes, sneaking in and scaring the shit out of them in the middle of the night. He decided he was going to do this to Joan. You'll remember her. We met her late night at the laundromat. And he drives to Vacaville, Indiana, to complete this task because she deleted his comment on his mother's obituary. Before he can check into his motel, he, of course, ends up in a confessional talking to a priest who confesses back to Moses that this is his last day in the priesthood. Drama day for Moses on his way to getting glow paint. We spend the rest of the section with Tiffany and James, our teacher who's 42 and our student 17, who have an affair and how their worlds collide and then dramatically fall apart. We spend a lot of time in Tiffany's head right up until the minute she changes her name to Blandine, mind blown, and enrolls in the independence class where she meets her future roommates. This timeline is going back and forth with what we read in the first section, but we are still not up to the quote-unquote event, the act of violence that changes the way that they're living their lives. We end this section with some quotes from Blandine's nightstand and her extremely active, intelligent, and wild brain.
Katie, you were sort of iffy on this book when we first started. Is the iffiness continuing? How are you feeling this week?
I still feel a little bit iffy about it, but I think I like the book in general. I think that it's clear that Tess Gunty is an incredibly talented writer. This is the first thing she's written. I have no idea how this level of intellect and poetry lives inside someone's head, and this is their first novel. I don't know how I feel about this book in general, but I will for sure pick up anything else she writes in the future and finish this book. I think for most of this section, I was annoyed that we were like meeting another quote unquote main character and spending so much time in Tiffany's head talking about James. Then when it came out that Tiffany was actually Blandine, I felt a little better, but I still don't know that there's enough plot and storyline that I'm bought into. There's a lot to keep track of, and I don't know that it is captivating as far as plot pulling me through, but I think that the way that she writes and the depth in which her characters think and are formed, especially Blandine, there's a lot of really great one-liners. Every line seems important and deep and material to who her characters are. I just feel like it's maybe more of a literary kind of work of art than it is a story, but that could change depending on how the plot kind of forms from here. But I just feel like the plot points are a little bit by the wayside. I know that was a long answer to your question, but that is how I'm feeling so far today.
I can see how people would not see that Tiffany was Blandine, but there were some hints. I was pretty confident it was Blandine pretty early on. And so then it's like very satisfying to figure out like why she ended up changing her name and like when that all happens. But it does kind of remind me of like the new mom in the apartment building, where like we did spend a lot of time with this mom who's dealing with the trials of postpartumness, and it was very deep and it was very emotional and it kind of was its own short story almost.
Right.
So I was willing to let Tiffany be just a side story, but I'm glad it ended up being Blandine. I think now we understand why she's the way that she is, why she's so sort of disillusioned and almost broken because of this relationship.
I think when I read books too, like I am rarely trying to figure out who somebody is. Like I'm really trying to like figure out what the author was thinking or who this person is. Like I'm trying to just experience the story and like how the author wanted you to read it, I guess. So looking back, there are definitely hints, but I think that you like read a story and you also think about the story at the same time, which is like, I don't have that brain capacity. I don't know how you do that. It's impressive. But I feel like I was surprised, but also relieved that it was Blandine. I do feel like it feels, and maybe that's it. I think she's a great writer and I'm enjoying reading it, but I feel like it feels like a bunch of short stories and the tie together pieces feel a little bit loose and underdeveloped to me at this point. But it's not that I'm not enjoying these short stories. I think that they're saying a lot about what it means to be a human. I think that the inside of the stories, you're getting so much meaning out of it. I just feel like I'm reading three short stories. And it's not a bad thing. It's just a thing.
Right. It's also short stories that are so connected. It's almost like Lessons in Chemistry, which we just read, where you're like, how is this possible that all of these circles are overlapping? Like, I'm positive James is going to come back in some way. And like, the priest is going to end up being some, like, there's just every character seems to have multiple roles and connections to every other character. And what are the chances that that happens? Like, what are the chances that Elsie, this celebrity, loves this one car that happens to be manufactured or was manufactured in Vacaville? It's like, come on. It's a little too small worldy almost.
Right. I agree with that. Everything seems perfectly timed. Like, you have to tie the short stories together. I feel like in writing this novel, you're like, I'm going to write these multiple perspectives, this big cast of characters, so I have to tie them together. But it seems like there were the short stories, and then she was like, what is the path to tie these together again? Because, of course, Moses has to go back to this small town in Indiana where his mom's from, even though he, like, literally lives in Malibu, to avenge his comment deleter with glow paint on his body. Like, that man, so interesting. Everyone is just a little bit unhinged, which I kind of love. I guess let's stick with the actual writing style and how we're feeling about it so far, so we can kind of talk about how it's written and then we can get into kind of the plot points. What did you think about this section? There was a lot of kind of what we called last time, like, mixed media or quotes intertwined with reading something. What did you think about the way that it was written?
I think it's fun. I like that it keeps you guessing. I don't mind short story collections, and sometimes I like them even better than a novel because you get so many, like, different perspectives and you sort of are jumping around. And that's sort of how I think this book is turning out to be. It's not what I expected, but I don't mind that. And then I think the different style chapters also keep it entertaining. You don't know what is coming next in terms of how the flow or the story is going to unfold. And a lot of times what she's doing is cluing us into things about the characters in ways that are not typical plot format, which I think are so cool. Like, reading someone's journal where they wrote down all the quotes that they really liked from a book. It's like, that tells you so much about what Blandine is thinking and what she's attracted to without having to say, Blandine was sitting in her room thinking about X, Y, and Z.
I love all the different ways that she's telling this story. I cannot stop thinking about reading the test they're taking in class. So you're reading the test questions, and then in between the test questions in italics, you're listening to the gossip of the students about Tiffany, Blandine, and James. So you're seeing what everyone's thinking, but they're in the middle of a test. And then also, though, the test questions have meanings. They're like, translate this passage. And then it's the girls gossiping about Tiffany's home life and her mom being an addict and her dad being out of the picture. And so the author is telling you, like, translate this. What do they think about Tiffany? How are they processing her experience? But also translate the passage is just the test question. So it's like everything has this double, deeper meaning, which I think is amazing. I love it. I love the way that part is written.
It's a very rich book. It reminds me of, like, eating, like, a ganache. It's like, it's really good, but you sort of have to take it slowly and with, like, a lot of espresso. Like, you can't just, like, guzzle it down like a milkshake.
I feel like I'm reading an Oscars movie, which I am not an Oscars movie girl. I just am not. It's just not my medium of choice. But I feel like a lot of my really good friends love them. And they'll be like, oh my God, but the lighting and the feeling and the talent and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, am I watching this movie to see the costume design? Or am I watching this movie to, like, feel something through this plot? And I think they're both correct opinions. It's just like, what are you getting out of it? And I think this feels like an Oscars movie. Like, everything about it is interesting and well done and beautiful. Is it something I'm going to watch on a Saturday night for fun? I don't know. Probably not.
Maybe. But I totally respect that. And I can recognize this is not a book for everyone. But the characters in this book, I feel like I know them so well. They're so particular. Even the list of things that Elsie likes, which is, like, intense flavors like mustard and wasabi and, like, her favorite recipe were these cabbage rolls but she never got the recipe. And it's like, you just learn so much about them. They feel so fully formed. Even the last interaction that Elsie and Moses have is like fat. You just feel like you're in that room when they look at each other, and it's like the last time they really connect as mother and son, and they realize how much they failed. And then she asks as her last thing to like never forgive me because I was a failure as a mother, which is like in its own way so fucked up, and still like making it about her. Oh, I just feel like the scenes are so good and these characters are so quirky, but they're very specific.
I think the characters are very real and very fully formed. I think that the level of depth she took with these characters and with this story is extremely ambitious for a debut author. So I'm just curious. Yes, we're getting inside all their heads. Is that the point? Are we, is like, how is it going to end? So I'm extremely curious to read the second half of this book. I think that there's a lot that has led us to this point. So I kind of feel like we're at maybe the climax of it, and I'm interested to see how the second half goes, but I definitely need to figure it out. I need to keep reading it. So I'll give her that.
Okay. Do you want to talk about James and Tiffany?
Oh, this whole storyline. I wrote down so many things reading this. I think that there's so much that's relatable in this, even as fucked up as this relationship is. I think her kind of working through, you see her work through it from the very beginning when she's falling for James to when she's kind of processing it during to afterwards when she's like, here's the list of reasons this was not okay. And I think that it'd be great if you could do all of those before making a decision. But part of being young is not doing those things before you make a decision. And I feel like I just could feel inside her that feeling of knowing this next decision that I'm going to make is going to change the trajectory of my life, but doing it anyways. And you're just like, oh no. And that is like so much of being young and figuring it out. And that's, you know, and that's part of the power dynamic that existed in this as well. It's like, it always was going to be detrimental to her. It was always going to be this like life forming event. And for him, I think it is too, but when you're older, you're able to like, he's able to kind of not let it affect his entire life and development as a human because he's already a fully formed human. Ugh.
So heartbreaking. It reminded me a lot of one of the stories from Three Women by Lisa Tudeau that you and I both loved. And Lisa does such a good job of explaining the tragedy of that relationship of a high school teacher and their student. And Tess also does that, but through Blandine's recognition of what she just went through and how she's devastated in the end because it's a cliche. She's like, of course, I have fallen into like tale as old as time. Mm-hmm. And I am no more unique than any, you know, nanny who sleeps with her employer's husband.
Right. How devastating and how absolutely boring.
And the recognition that like the real tragedy here is that it was always going to mean more to me than him. And he knew it and he didn't care. And it was just like the power differential, the everything about their relationship, the gaps in age, the gaps in lifestyle. It's like at the end of the day, the tragedy for Blandine is that like I cared and he didn't. And it's just like every, I just feel like every 17-year-old girl reads that and is just heartbroken. Yeah. And then in the end, I almost started crying when she gets the email and she realizes she's not even the only one.
Oh, I know. I knew that as soon as I saw that she was getting the email, I was like, oh, this is a pattern. This is James. Like, damn it. Because you just feel, even in that devastation, you feel your uniqueness. And then for that part to be ripped away as well, it's like, what even? Oh, and I think Tess does such a good job of identifying and speaking into words feelings that I have felt before but never maybe been able to articulate. The way she's describing that Tiffany feels like in order to be truly alive and living her life, she needs to be verified. She needs somebody to see her. And then on the contrast of that, James feeling like he has this crush, this feeling towards this girl who obviously he knows on some level this is not okay. But he's like, I just need to verify that that exists, that this is real, or I need to prove to myself it's not. So I need to bring her into my life, like kind of, you know, turn the lights on, bring her into the real world. And then the contrast of seeing her in the bed I share with my wife will maybe wake me up to that. And I think in some way he does, but what a selfish, awful way to do that, to get yourself out of this moment. I just feel like the way that she described both of those feelings happening at the same time, you're like, it's like watching a train wreck. This is, and you just feel for her so much in that moment.
So heartbreaking, and just my heart also breaks for like the little Erica and the little Katie that were also 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, you know, on and on dating older men who did this also. Because it's just, I just feel like every year I get farther away from being a teenager, I look back and just think like I was a child. She's a child. And Tiffany is so vulnerable and so alone and so already damaged that it just puts her whole character in perspective of like, she's not just some kooky girl who has white blonde hair and is obsessed with nuns. It's like her entire world has been shattered. And the only person she thought was like tethering her to reality is like completely gone and unavailable to her and a total fraud.
Every time I read a book like this where you meet somebody and they're kind of in a different phase of their life and you go back and figure out how they became the way you are, I think it just reminds you that humans, it's not that there's excuses for who people are, why they do things, but we exist in such a larger context than we ever give each other credit for. And then I just keep thinking back to Blandine, the first section, she's like, I just think we need to take each other a bit more seriously. Like, yeah, somebody, there's so much more depth to her and to everybody around her. I also keep thinking there's like so many one-liners in the book. I wrote down so many pages of moments when I was like, I just need to remember this or this will like live in my brain rent free forever. There was two of them that she said. One of them is like her struggling at night going through her routine. And then at 3 a.m. she's like still obscenely alive, like that wording. And then the other one I can't, like I keep thinking about too, is the pain reliever bottles. And she goes to James' house in the pretense of babysitting for his kids. That whole situation, like, also fucked up. She's babysitting for the kids, and the little girl's like, I don't like the pain reliever bottle where it says actual size. And then this is where you get the kind of almost too much at this one. And sometimes I feel like a little bit, we're a little bit too far out here as an author, but she's like, takes that and she's like, what I'm thinking in that moment is he's showing me his life. He's showing me so I don't murder it. Actual size. You're like, all right, the melodrama, but I'm here for it, but the melodrama.
I mean, we've been 17. The melodrama was high at that age.
You know what? Fair point.
But she's also, Blandine is also very insightful in recognizing too that it's not actually James that she wanted. It was like the piano, I think is how she says it.
Yeah, I wanted
it's like the idea of James. It's the story, the romance of it all, the being seen. Like that's really what she was swept up in. It almost has nothing to do with him as a person. And that also is its own. Yes. And that's also its own sort of tragedy.
And isn't that the truth of literally being 18? Like you just don't know yet. You know, there's just so much to learn and you feel so grown up. There's this such a contrast between being now 30 and looking back on who I thought that I was at 17 and 18, what I thought I knew, how experienced and worldly and grown up I thought I was. And then again, like you were saying earlier, like that person is a child and actually there was so much I didn't know. And that is why you have to rely on the people who have that experience to like not take advantage of the vulnerability of the moment of being a teenager or of being a child. And yeah, it's heartbreaking when it happens like this. And it's hard too, because at 17, at 18, at 19, like you are technically an adult, right? So like, you know, there's a lot of like technicality things happening here. Obviously she's 17, so that's, but she's above the age of consent in Indiana. So you're like, in the eyes of the law, are you technically fine? But like, that's when you kind of require the wisdom of somebody who knows that there are reasons that can't be identified in a code or a law that make this still not okay. And they're not his family. It's the age and power dynamic.
Speaking of heartbreaking children who are not loved correctly, we also have Moses and the story of why Moses is such a weirdo too, and the strained relationship with his mom. And what you were saying earlier about like the context that everyone has, I didn't really understand Moses until we have the story of him waking up after one of his mom's famous parties and going into the living room to see she's still there with all her drunk friends, and that, you know, they're teasing him, they're being obnoxious, they're being really mean to each other. And then in the end, his mom turns around and says, I don't even know who this kid is. I've never seen this person before in my life. And it's just, you just feel for that baby Moses who is just alone, totally on his own, rejected by his mom, dealing with this like weird cast of people in his house, and he just wants a glass of water, and he can barely form the sentences to say, like, I'm just thirsty, and none of them will help him. And he's in that disoriented, sleepy state. It's just so, so sad and heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's wild how that growing up in that space has affected him so much. It's not wild because it's typical, right? That's exactly what you would expect to happen. But it is heartbreaking to read it and see this poor kid who's just struggling and like ostracized in a lot of different ways. And the least of them being that he's just like in middle school, and that alone is difficult enough. And then on top of that, he's like famous, and there are so many things that go wrong. I just still am so curious about this glow paint situation. But I did enjoy when he's describing how his brain feels to the priest, which we can get there in a minute. But he's describing like the fibers in his, like he's feeling these fibers in his body. And he's like, I'm not going to tell you it unless you also feel it. And I think that is kind of like a how we process mental illness or anxiety or depression or whatever. Like, you don't get it unless you felt it kind of thing. So he's like not willing to talk about it because he's like, I don't want you to think my brain is crazy. I don't want you to, like, you know, ask me too many questions if you'll just never understand.
I really also admire how specific Tess is. Like, I don't know how she comes up with this stuff. Like, the story of how Moses, first of all, the glow paint thing is hilarious and so random. So I don't know where she got that idea. But then also that, like, when he was younger and being teased by a bully in his classroom, she would draw him as the moon and, like, all the other kids like running away from it, or like him being so separate. It's so specific, but it's also like that's such a thing a little kid would do, and it would hurt so bad to be like, oh, I'm the moon, I'm like separate from everyone, and like I that's like such a way a kids bully each other.
Kids are the worst, first of all. Second of all, I like took the moon thing, maybe this is completely incorrect, which is hilarious, but like, was he overweight in elementary school?
Yeah, I think he was.
So I was like then taking the moon as him being like giant also. None of them are nice, but I just wasn't even thinking about the separation. It's like kids are evil, and also there's just no way to get out of middle school unless going through it. And it's just, ugh,
the worst. Like, kudos, again, kudos to Tess, because how specific is that?
Right.
And so like, yeah, totally a kid would do that.
What are you getting so far as kind of like the main message of this book, or the main, like, is it just to kind of read and understand the perspective of these different people in this very specific dying Midwestern city, low income household, to be able to familiarize yourself with their specific, you know, and quirky plights, or kind of how are you feeling about the general meaning of it?
I don't know. It's a little early, but I think we have a theme with like the town, with Blandine, with her roommates, and even with Moses, of like people who are overlooked or abandoned, and like the parts of the country that we don't want to look at, where, you know, we have this whole scene where Blandine is walking through the town and describing how this like factory came in and built all these cars and then like totally abandoned this city, or like farming would come in and like take all of the resources from this one plot of land and then leave like a dust bowl behind. And so there's this like theme of abandonment, and I think that also sort of what Blandine and Moses share is being overlooked by people that should have their best interests or should love them in some way, and they feel very alone and outcast, and I think that's what's tying things together, but I don't know.
Yeah,
willing to revise that as we keep reading.
Yeah, I was just curious what the kind of vibes were you were getting so far about the tie together of the story. I think that's kind of where I'm at too. Like, it's these people who are seen, right, they're alone or they're quote unquote dying or they're not, whatever, but like how truly alive and heart beating these cities and these people and these traumatized youth, et cetera, and are like still alive. I don't know if that made sense, but we shall see.
I can't wait to keep reading. I can't wait to know what happens.
Me neither.
Okay. Talk, talk.
Talk, talk. It has been a real slow start to this year for me, and I'm like annoyed and trying not to be like, I'm already behind, but that's how I feel. And I think the true cause of this is that I picked up a 500-page book to start, and that was just a huge mistake. But it was an okay book. It was The Bookshop of Second Chances, which I've talked about a couple of times, about this girl who inherits the cottage in Scotland. Overall, I think it was very sweet. It was like a love story, but it was a, like, she's finding who she is post-divorce, and he's finding who he is in the light of his family drama, who were like lords in Scotland, and he doesn't want to be any part of that. So I think there was, and like the town is cute, it's cozy. The book could have been 300 pages and I would have loved it. It was 500 and I was bored for 200 of them. So that's upsetting, because I feel like there was potential and I would just like to speak to the editor about it, because I feel like it could be so much better. On top of that, I'm reading currently, obviously, The Rabbit Hutch. I'm reading The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. Finally, I read the first 50 pages last night because I was like, oh, this is going to be like reading a movie, the opposite of kind of the depth that this book has. And then Jen and I and our moms are reading Spare together.
So cute.
So funny. Jen's mom and my mom both love the royal family. And like Jen did too. She'd like wake up and watch Kate's Wedding or whatever. So we're reading Harry's book, Prince Harry's book together.
Fascinating. Dan was on the Colbert Show when Prince Harry was the guest.
Oh, it's almost like I know Prince Harry.
I know. He said that his response was, a lot of people are going to be pissed about this book, meaning like the royal family, I think, and the firm, as they call them, mm-hmm. the powers that be around the family. And also that Prince Harry's really, really tall. He was like, I was really surprised. For some reason, I didn't know. Yeah, he's like 6'5". He's really tall.
Well, then Meghan must be really tall.
Yeah, Meghan also must be tall. Which
because
is why
that is why I feel like everyone thinks he's just 6 feet, is because there's no way she's not like 5'5". So they must all just be really tall.
Could be. Could be true.
We'll never know.
We could definitely Google it and know immediately. Check the show notes. I'll put it in the show notes.
Prince Harry is 6'5". Okay. What have you read? I feel like you're probably like read 10 books in January.
No, I also am doing the same thing. I've been like bouncing from book to book. I can't decide what I want to read. I finished Manhunt. I don't even know how I felt about that book. I wouldn't recommend it. It's pretty intense in terms of like the, it's like a zombie movie. So you're like reading about a lot of violence and it's like really gross. And then there's a lot of like very descriptive sex scenes. And I think the part that's really tough for me is that it's like in this world where cis women are being the worst of themselves, which is cis women are not true allies. All of the rhetoric of being trans inclusive is basically meaningless, and they are quick to immediately take up the mantle of the patriarchy in the absence of men. I think that's depressing to believe that women would basically immediately take over and like military reign over the world in the absence of men. Men in the book too are the worst that men are, which is just like drooling, sex hungry, and like will devour anything that come in their path and are total destroyers. And that's tough. And then all of the trans characters are very similar in that they're like extremely horny 24/7 in the middle of like a zombie apocalypse, which like maybe. And then there's one main character who is a fat woman of color, and like I'm so happy that there's like fat representation in an apocalypse movie, to be like fat people would be there too and they would have like unique challenges and experiences of something like that. But every single time the character is brought up, she has to talk about something about her size, something about her body composition, something about how she relates to food. And it's just like, she is a full character as well. There are other things to this character. I guess my main issue is that within the set of trans characters in the book, they are all very similar in some ways. And within the set of cis women, they're all very similar in some ways. And obviously the men have no speaking parts because they're all monsters. So I just think it's a little bit of a failure of imagination. I wish we had some more, not diversity, but just uniqueness among those characters. Without that, it just felt kind of depressing to like reduce all the characters down to their worst, at least cis women and cis men, to reduce them down to their absolute worst stereotypes almost.
That does sound depressing, to at least reduce them all to the worst that people can be, because I feel like we get a lot of experience that in your day-to-day life. You're like, no, I already know what the worst people can be is. Can I just get a little bit of hope that maybe there's like one good one stuck in here somewhere that can kind of help us pull this part through? So I think that would be frustrating to read. Doesn't seem like a book I'm going to pick up. I can say that.
It's something we talked about when we recorded our episode about The Power, but the idea that in the absence of men in positions of power, women would immediately take up the same systems of violence and domination, I just don't know if I believe that. And I think The Power did a good job of showing how different women navigated and responded to that differently. And I think, I don't know, I guess I'm not sold on the idea that women would be as violent, power hungry, conniving, whatever, if there were no men, you know, on Wall Street or in the White House or whatever.
I think that's the nuanced part of it, right? Like, I think The Power does a better job, it sounds like, than the book you're describing now, in being like, yes, of course, some women would be evil. Some women are evil now. So, like, of course, that still happens. But there is a nuanced point of view where it's not all of them as a whole, which I think is kind of what you're saying about this book in general. Are you reading anything else?
I started Cloud Cuckoo Land, which is like 900 pages. And then I was like, why am I doing this to myself? Like, what's happening? So I don't know. I have this other book called Cursed Bunny, LOL. That's a book of short stories. And like, how many bunny related books can I read at the same time? At least two.
I mean, I think minimally two. I also got a book, The Age of Ice by Deepti Kapoor. And I got it and I realized it's 630-ish pages. And I was like, well, I can't, absolutely not. It's not a January book because I'm already behind. So maybe it's a vacation book or a March book. It looks great, but I can't do it. It's a luxe thriller set in New Delhi, and it's like a family saga set in India. So I think it's going to be super interesting, but it's too long. Who are these people? In looking at this, it says the book itself weighs 1.9 pounds. For what?
Yeah, that's a lot. Well, hopefully we'll find some inspiration in our books next week.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yikes.
Book Talk is made by me, Erica Bailey, and Katie Cheney, with production support from Dan White. Our theme music is by Dan White. We'll see you next week.